Alright, so, it's the last day of class. We did it. Well, I guess there's the final still. I did it. I got it. So last time we talked about Kepler, the Kepler mission, and using it to detect exoplanets using the transit method. I found some transit light curves, just to show you an example of what those actually look like. You know, sort of if you want to think about what the data actually is showing you in these cases. So what we're seeing here is each data point is a single observation of the star that's being observed and how bright it is, scaled relative to like the average maximum brightness of that star, right? So that's what the black line is showing on the edges, basically, and then the dip shows the average of the data points throughout the light curve here. But it's not that you see necessarily the data points like this, it's that you're sampling data points and you're folding them over on each other over and over again. So this is what we call a phase diagram, where you're figuring out what the period is and then dividing all of the data points by that, so that you go basically from 0 to 1 in the repeated thing. So you see overall, this might be, each data point might be separated by 6 hours or something, and not the length of the transit, but you take each data point and stack it up, sort of plot relative to the period, and that shows you this overall light curve for all the transits together. So these might be data points for the entire Kepler mission of this particular planet. But all together, they form a nice looking dip, right? But I want you to notice here, right? So if you sort of zoom in here up on these figures up here at the top, those look like sunspots, basically, right? But those are the relative sizes of the planets to the star that they're orbiting around, right? Each one of these is a planetary system. This is Kepler 132 is a binary star, and each star has its own planets orbiting around it, which is pretty cool. And then Kepler 11 over here has 6 planets around it. What I want you to notice with these diagrams is the scale on the y-axis, right? Where if 1 is the average maximum brightness of that star, the amount of dip that we're talking about here is like 1 part in 10,000, right? That's a small effect to notice or something. So these are really precise diagrams, really precise observations. So that sort of 1 part in 10,000 is getting you sort of like Earth-ish size things. So the deeper you go, the bigger the planet, right? And the wider they are, the longer it takes for that planet to go across, right? So this is a particularly noticeable transit because it's nice and wide. Things like this that are really short, you have to be really hoping that you get a good baseline observation so that you can pick out the dip. But it's an example of actual data. I just wanted to show that off. Okay. The next thing I wanted to talk about was equilibrium temperature. Right? We sort of alluded to this when we talked about the gas giants in the solar system having actual temperatures that are bigger than their equilibrium temperature. What do we mean by equilibrium temperature?
It's a temperature at which the incoming radiation equals the outgoing radiation.
Right. So if you imagine black body radiation, right? A black body re-emits all of the light that it absorbs. So you have some amount of light hitting a planet, and the planet will re-radiate that light, all of it, away. The equilibrium temperature is the temperature of the light that's being radiated away, right? So it's the temperature at which the planet is in balance. The planet's luminosity is in balance with the luminosity that the star puts into the planet. So the way you can calculate that is with the equation here at the top. So equilibrium temperature TEQ equals the temperature of the star times the square root of the radius of the star divided by 2 times the semi-major axis of the planet's orbit. And then this last term here, 1 minus AB squared. AB here is what we call the albedo. We haven't really referenced that yet in this class, but albedo is basically the fraction of light that's reflected away from the planet. So it's saying how much light can you actually absorb, right? So you can think of reflective surfaces, right, on planets, right? Clouds are white, they reflect a lot of light. Snow, ice, that's gonna reflect a lot of light. Different color surfaces have different albedos, and so each planet will have a different reflectivity depending on how its composition is, whether it has ice on the surface, whether it has an atmosphere that has clouds, right? There's lots of different things that can go into that. So the only really way to know that number is just to measure, right? Try and put some light in. If you know the amount of light that goes in, how much do you get back out? And that tells you your reflectivity, basically your albedo. But the light that you don't reflect gets absorbed, and that's why we have 1 minus, because 1 minus reflectivity is absorptivity, I guess. That's not an actual word, absorptivity, but you get the idea. Equilibrium temperature is really only meant to describe in an ideal scenario, right? If you have no atmosphere around the planet, it can just radiate away all of its energy. In reality, your ability to keep heat in is going to depend on a lot of different things. So first of all, whether you have an atmosphere or not. Second of all, what the composition of that atmosphere is. If you have a lot of greenhouse gases, that's going to keep in a lot more heat than if you didn't have any greenhouse gases. And then if you have some internal source of heat as well, right? So that's what we were talking about when we were talking about the gas and ice giants, right? There's extra heat on the inside that's trying to get out, and that makes the planet look like it's hotter than its equilibrium temperature should be. So why do we care about equilibrium temperature? Sophia?
I had a question.
Yeah.
If you just said it's hot, the planet is hotter than its equilibrium temperature should be. Mm-hmm. Is that just another way to say it's not in equilibrium?
Yes.
With regard to temperature?
Correct. Yeah. It's out of equilibrium, right? So over time, a planet should approach the equilibrium temperature, should cool off and reach that equilibrium temperature. If a planet is not at its equilibrium temperature, there's some reason that it's hanging on to heat. So either it has internal heating or an atmosphere or some other way. But those are going to be the three main ones. Why do we care about equilibrium temperature? I mean, you know, we want to know whether or not something is cool all the way or not. That's an interesting thing to know about a planet. But if we're talking about exoplanets, we're looking for Earth-like planets. We want to know what planets will have surface conditions like that of Earth. So what do the surface conditions on Earth look like in general? I mean, you live here, right? What is the, like, what's the average temperature on Earth's surface, for example, ballpark? Sophia? Someone said a number, what was the number?
25 Celsius.
25 Celsius, right? You know, sort of, you know, what would that be in Fahrenheit? 70-ish room temp, call it room temperature, right? Somewhere in that ballpark, right? You're sort of in the, somewhere between water freezing and water boiling, right? You're gonna be in that pocket of 0 to 100 Celsius somewhere, right? There's water vapor in the air, there's ice on the ground, but there's liquid water everywhere. It's gonna be, you know, kind of 50 C, say. That's really hot, right? It's obviously not 50 C, but. I mean, there's a little box there on this graph, but there's liquid water, right? That's important. There's an atmosphere, right? We have weather. There's all sorts of things that go into our surface conditions here on Earth. But basically, the important ones are liquid water, atmosphere, relatively cool temperature, but not so cold that there's ice, and not so hot that there's no liquid water. What we would call just right, right? If we're thinking about Goldilocks here, it's just right. So we can put together the idea of a concept called the habitable zone, which is basically saying, what are the range of orbits around the star where you can have liquid water on the surface as long as you have an atmosphere that has sufficient pressure, right? If you have liquid water in a vacuum, there's not gonna be pressure there, right? You need to have an atmosphere to have an Earth-like planet. Apparently you can have liquid water on an atmosphereless planet, but it's pretty rare. You need to have some pressure to keep it in. The reason for that is shown here. This is the phase diagram for water. So on the y-axis, we have pressure. On the left-hand side, that's in units of pascals. And that's some metric unit, right? I'm dissing metric now. On the right, we have, it's in units of bars, which is sort of a metric unit, but one bar is approximately equal to one atmosphere. So that's a sort of a good way of thinking about, right? One bar is Earth, the sea level on Earth. So 10 bar is 10 atmospheres, more or less. It's like 0.99 atmospheres is one bar. It's some weird. It's defined as exactly 100 kilopascals, pascals. And Earth's surface pressure is like 1.13 or something. 1.013. Somewhere it says on there. And then on the x-axis, we have temperature. So on the top up there, it's in Kelvin, but something that's more human readable is Celsius, which is at the bottom, right? So 0 Celsius is the freezing point of water, and 100 is the boiling point. So you can see, right? So the green is where you can have liquid water. The orange is where you can have water vapor. And then blue is ice, solid water. Don't worry about what all the Roman numerals mean. There's different kinds of ice. I'm not going to remotely get into that. Ice is weird. Super weird. But, right, so the important thing, right, is that if you think about what Earth's surface conditions are, if you're somewhere around, like, 30 C at one atmosphere, that puts you right here smack dab in the middle of the liquid water part. Venus is over here. Its surface temperature and pressure are too high and too hot. I mean, I wouldn't want to live in 350 plus C. It's not going to work out for me. I could barely handle when it's 70 degrees in here. So Venus is out, right? And then Mars is pretty close to what we call that triple point, where you can have a combination of all three at the same time. But this, if you sort of imagine this vertical line dropping down, right, you can't have liquid water below a certain pressure. That's why you need some atmosphere at a given temperature, at least. So you can imagine, right, putting together parts of this diagram where you can have liquid water. You can imagine what a range of temperatures around a star would be, at, you know, what you can calculate the equilibrium temperature at radii around the star. You can mock out part of this diagram where you can have liquid water around that star. And it's going to sort of fall in this wedge here, right? So that's the habitable zone, where you can have liquid water given sufficient surface pressure. If we think about that in sort of more of a stellar properties way, right? So if we imagine here's the temperature of the star on the y-axis. So starting down here at like 2500 Kelvin, going up to about 7000, the sun will be here, right? That's around 6000 Kelvin. And then on the bottom, we have the fraction of light that you get, so the brightness, basically, right, at that planet relative to how much we get here on Earth. So Earth better be at 100%. There it is, that's good. And then the lines here are basically saying, okay, for a given star, right, if you have a brighter star, your habitable zone is closer, the brighter edge of your habitable zone is going to move in. Things get too hot, and the cool edge, everything shifts in. Sorry, just thinking for a second here. It doesn't make sense what I just said. This shows the habitable zone edges, right, for different temperatures of stars. They're not talking about how far away from that star it is. They're talking about how much light you get for a given temperature relative to Earth. So for habitable things, you can define habitable zone kind of any way you want. We want there to be liquid water. That gives you a pretty wide range of temperatures that you can work with. If you want to say, let's go for it, you know, let's assume that we, you know, you could have life that lives in nearly boiling water. I don't know that that would look like we do, but, you know, it's life. You can kind of go into the hotter edge of that. But more conservatively, you might want to say it's something more like things colder, right? You're going to look for colder water. You don't want hot boiling water. Things can live in cold better than they can live in hot, the longer at least. So this is sort of deciding your habitable zone for you. If you think about what that looks like for the sun in terms of radius away, that's what we're seeing over here on the right-hand side. Sophia.
Could you just go zoom out a little so we can see the left graph? What is starlight? What unit is that in? Like
percentage watts? Relative to what we have here.
But like just sunlight, is that like the watts per meter squared?
Yeah, watts per square meter. Yeah. So
but
just a multiple
that,
of
so
that.
So that's like proportional to the temperature, but it's not like 1 to 1, right?
Correct. Because the lumen, because it's based on luminosity, which also depends on the radius of the star. Yeah.
Steve has a question.
Steve,
you're
in my peripheral vision.
Out of the 10,000 exoplanets that we've discovered,
yes.
Is this like just a sample, or are these straight up the only ones that have those?
Yes, so I guess I failed to mention, right, this is plotting exoplanets on here.
Yeah.
I think this is pretty much close to it. We may have a handful more now, but these are going to be, you know, Earth-like planets in the habitable zone. Earth-like in terms of mass and radius, surface gravity type stuff. There may be ones outside the habitable zone, but this is pretty much it. There might also be bigger or smaller planets in there too, right? You could have a Jupiter in there. I mean, yeah, not necessarily a hot Jupiter, but, you know. David?
What's the difference between the optimistic and the conservative habitable zones?
I'd say optimistic, we're just sort of saying, like, the idea there is that you're including more possible definitions of what would be living there.
Right, so it's...
So that, you know, could life live on Venus? Maybe? Kind of that kind of thing, right? More conservatively, you'd be worried that things don't survive in boiling water.
But is it that they're just like, they're increasing the parameters, or they're actually adding new things that are required?
They're just saying the hot edge of that
is
hotter than it would be. Right, I mean, if you take the line that they've drawn here, right, Earth is, you know, just inside that. But if Earth were around this star, it would be, yeah.
It's like you should, I guess you could think of the conservative zone as all of the Earth's oceans. I mean, whales, sharks, fish live in the oceans, but know, we found hydrothermal vents that the water's really, really hot, but still just a life living around those vents. And so that's the optimistic zone.
Okay.
It's hot water.
Yeah.
Life can still exist there.
Yeah.
There's life, but it's
not a lot.
Not a lot, and not very, you know, not big. You know, it's like you're talking like little, like,
yeah.
What are those things called? Tardigrades?
Uh-huh.
Little, like, space potato bear things.
Yeah.
Sophia?
So, why is it that for a lower temperature star, it's more likely to have life on a planet that receives less sunlight compared to a high temperature star? Like, the way that the yellow light.
Yeah.
Why is that? Why?
I'm trying to figure out the shape of the curve here.
It's pretty hard.
I'm not sure.
Is it maybe have to do with like depending on the temperature it's gonna emit different types of light and like some of it would be harmful?
Maybe
for a low temperature star like the
I guess more what I'm wondering is why aren't they just vertical lines, right? Why do we care if, why is a habitable zone around a little M dwarf star only extend to 150 versus 200 for a sun-like star? That doesn't make a lot of, I don't know. I'm going to say I don't know why they chose this particular shape.
Well, they didn't choose the shape, they chose the science.
Someone drew a line on here, right?
Yeah.
An arbitrary line. And I don't know why they chose that particular arbitrary line.
It's arbitrary.
I'm sure they have reasons, but I don't know what those reasons are. Unfortunately. I think the fact that we're looking at different stars here isn't necessarily helpful, right? So what I was going to do is zoom in on our solar system, right? So what these three diagrams are showing are actual orbital distance away. I think this is the confusing factor in the other graph, is that we're not talking about distance, we're talking about brightness. Incident luminosity, basically. But here we can just fix one star. Well, what we have here is the sun evolving over time as you go from bottom to top. So down here, right, let's not worry about that yet, but let's say, okay, here, where the planets are plotted here on this plot are where we are right now. Right? So the edge of your habitable zone is just outside of Venus's orbit. Earth is nicely in the middle and Mars is in there but getting close to the colder edge of it. So Mars, by our current definition of this habitable zone, is good. You could have liquid water there. There is potential evidence of liquid water on Mars. It doesn't stick around for very long. There's plenty of water ice on Mars. Because it's colder. Mars has a much lower surface pressure than Earth does. But it's possible to have it. But what do we notice about what's happening with this shape of this habitable zone over time here? It's changing, right? As the sun gets hotter, that's sort of what you're seeing here, hotter or brighter. As the sun gets brighter, things shift outwards because you have to maintain the same range of temperatures, and to do that you have to get further away from a brighter star. So early on in the solar system's life, things shifted around a bit as the sun kind of collapsed down. What's really interesting to think about is what happens after the sun becomes a red giant and starts getting really big. Right? Here's the sun as it goes up, sort of away from the main sequence. It starts getting hotter. Now the habitable zone is Jupiter, Saturn.
Yeah.
And then by the time the sun sort of turns into a white dwarf, that habitable zone is getting pretty small. So, you know, in 5 billion years, maybe it actually would be good to have life on, you know, one of the moons of Jupiter. It's going to be a bit more in that habitable zone region there. This sort of brings up a question I wanted to ask you, have you think about. What about moons? Right, we talked about how
Europa has an ocean of liquid water under the surface. We haven't really thought about that in our definition of habitable zone relative to the star, but Jupiter's moons are way outside the sun's habitable zone. We still have liquid water there. Does that mean anything for the possibility of life? Or we talk about going to Europa to look for signs of life. So there are more places than just the habitable zone that you can look, right? You just really need liquid water and some source of heat to keep things from freezing or otherwise doing something.
Okay. So the next thing to talk about, this is where our fun activity begins.
The Drake equation. So this is a way for us to make an educated guess about how much life is actually out there, like us, right? Intelligent, communicating. Here he is, Frank Drake, looking like he's about to head out to the club.
That looks like an alien.
So Frank Drake, 60 years ago yesterday, wrote down this equation, which we now call the Drake equation, which has kind of stayed the same over time. People have debated this and talked about the different terms and what they mean and what null values should be. What this equation is trying to find is the number of detectable civilizations in our galaxy with us right now. Right now or ever? Right now. So there are 7 parameters here that we have to think of what that number should be. You can be optimistic, you can be pessimistic. You can try and figure out what that number actually is based on data. And by multiplying all 7 of these parameters together, you arrive at a number that tells you how many detectable communicating civilizations there are in the Milky Way with us. Well, and including us, I guess. So the first one of these is the rate at which stars are born in the Milky Way. We can tell you that number. We know that one. It's about 1 solar mass per year. Sophia?
That seems way too convenient. Why is it like that?
It's just how it is.
Is it because our sun is like kind of average?
Yeah, probably. Okay. It really has more to do with the amount of gas there is in the Milky Way and how much of it is dense enough to start collapsing to form a star.
What are like the error bars on that?
Probably fairly large, like 25-30%.
Okay, that's not bad.
But it's, I mean, let's just round to 1 for it, right? It could be 2, it could be half, you know. Call it 1. 1 solar mass per year. The next parameter here. This is a fraction between 0 and 1, right? How many stars have planets? The next one is the number of habitable planets you have per planetary system, right? So a star that has planets, how many planets on average does a star with planets have? Right? The sun has 9 that we know about. My 2005 is slipping in here. 8, right? There are 8 planets. There's a couple dwarf planets. We'll just round it up to 9. You know? Planetary, dwarf. We'll throw Pluto a bone here. He can be a planet again. Pluto, there's 9 planets. Call it 10. Why not? Ceres can be a planet too.
Just love for Ceres.
Yeah. So, you know, that could be, we have no idea, right? We have to guess at a number there, right? We can see we have multiple planet systems that we know about, right? The TRAPPIST system we talked about last time has eight planets, a couple in the habitable zone, three in the habitable zone. You know, Earth has, you have Earth, maybe Earth, Mars in the solar system, right? So you're kind of in 2 to 3 range here, but you know, you could have more, you could have less, you have one, you have four, right? Pick a number. This is where we start getting a little more speculative, right? The fraction of those habitable planets that actually life evolves, right? Some fish crawls out of the ocean. Well, I guess that's like step 50.
Yeah.
But, you know, I don't know, lightning strike on a cup of tea or something, you know, you get some organic molecules that turn, I don't know. I'm not a biologist, right? Somehow you get life, right? I don't know. What fraction of planets that are possibly habitable end up having something that lives there? Next is, how many of those fish get a brain and can be intelligent? How many of those fish that have brains develop technology that they can use to communicate off of their planet? And then, how long do they stick around doing that? That's a real speculative number, right? We've made it a good 10,000 years. How many more will we last? I don't know.
As a famous scientist said, you know, dolphins satisfy a lot of those, but they've been around as long as we have, and they haven't built a radio telescope.
That's true. Yeah, I mean, whales are really smart, right?
Octopi.
Octopus. There's that Netflix movie, right? The octopus teacher thing. I watched half of that. It was really cool. No spoilers. There's lots of intelligent life on Earth, but none of it can talk to each other the way we can talk to each other over a radio, right? I mean, maybe a dolphin could learn how to use a radio. They don't have thumbs.
Really?
Yes. Really. So this is the Drake equation, right? We can, based on our assumptions, we can talk about what each one of these numbers should be, and we can come to an answer, right? What is the number? David?
I don't have an answer for the number, but it seems like there's a lot of error that goes into this, because, like...
Boy, oh yes, there is.
The assumptions for fraction of those plants which actually life evolves, like, just that by itself is... That's just crazy.
I've seen well-reasoned arguments where the final number is, oh my god, we're alone in this galaxy, and it's a fluke we exist.
Right.
And I've seen, there should be someone next door.
Okay.
With very well-reasoned arguments. This is not like E equals MC squared, where there is an answer. It's all very much.
Sophia?
Can I, like, say some numbers, or?
Well, don't get ahead of me, because I'm going to have you work through it. In your groups, right? I want you to go through and, do you know our star, right? That's one star per year, right? So you're right, the units work out, right? This is per year, and this is in years at the end, right? So you just have a number. Dimensional analysis for the win. Yeah.
Okay, but I still have something to say that doesn't spoil.
Go ahead.
That's okay. Like I've read that the like the original estimates vary by like six, like the optimistic versus the conservative is like 6 orders of magnitude, but modern it's like 20 orders of magnitude.
Yeah, I mean, yeah.
So that's interesting.
Yeah. Joanne, did you have a question?
Yeah, I was just gonna, like that picture they took of him, like it looks like this is like some really, really good equation. But I'm just confused, like,
so, okay,
how
so
often is this used for anything actually scientific?
There's a link. This article came out yesterday in honor of the anniversary of him coming up with this equation, right? He was like the first person to try and detect signs of life with radio telescopes from other places. And somebody came up to him and they were like, can you organize a conference to, you know, bring some people in and talk about what, like, how should we do this as a field, right? And he was like, yeah, sure, I can do that. And then like a couple weeks went by, he was like, shit, what were you gonna talk about? And he just jotted this down. like, this is a good place to start. Like, these are the things we have to think about. And it kind of rolled from there, right? They brought in, like, Carl Sagan and, you know, all the usual cast of characters, and they all got drunk, and, you know, astronomers are, you know, a little...
His daughter interviewed him in that article,
yeah.
and he was very surprised that this equation has stuck around for 60
yeah,
years, that no one's changed it.
He basically said, like, I just made some shit up at the last minute, and I'm really surprised that, like, it's actually stuck around like this. But it seems to be that he really did come up with sort of the set of parameters that actually have some sort of meaning, and but we have really no idea about a lot of them. We're kind of stepping our way through, like, we can maybe start to answer the second one now a little bit with data, but after that it's anybody's guess, right? So this is all stuff that's really a lot more theoretical than it really should be, maybe. So I don't think he ever expected it to be us talking about it in a class 60 years later. You know, that's not something. Yeah, did get his homework done, basically. So, we'll post the link to that article somewhere that you can read it. It's pretty fun. So, I would like you to do this as an exercise. So, take like the next like 15, 20 minutes, right? Go through, talk about each one of these, argue with each other, write down your assumption for each one, calculate a final number, and then we'll report back and have sort of a conference of our own. We can talk about what the different things we have to think about are. Sophia?
Can you tell us, like, the actual number for the second two?
No.
Fine.
I can give you a rough estimate.
Yeah. Well, 10. I don't mean, like, the actual true number. I mean, like, what the best that we know.
10%.
For FP?
Call 10%. But you can, if you want to adjust that up or down, you can, right?
Yeah.
That's up to you.
Any.
Come with a prelim number of 10%.
I think it's 10%. Oh, I meant for the second one. So the third one.
There is a different way to think about this, David, which is to say how many planets in the star do we have, and then what fraction of those are habitable. If you want to think about it.
This is the right thing.
That's like the only.
Yes,
is this right now? Or just.
Oh, right. Well, because the last one is the average time. Like,
alright, so
okay.
Like detectable in the sense that.
So you're saying there's 4 months for
like. Well, like,
very little.
You're 25% or lower.
It's not that close.
Yeah.
Even if it's
no, it's a fraction of the
yeah,
so I would say
0.2
means like in theory.
I'd say like 0.00.
Yeah, no, it's means like. Because, like,
dude, that chance for what you
so let's say we have like 10
so
we're and like, this is like
0.001.
Like, you probably protect us. We only know about like, the chances of anything actually.
If you
want
to go with
like, there's a lot of places that we have.
Because life, like, most of us takes
well, yeah, it takes. I mean, it takes a lot of time, but also
yeah,
needs to like start.
Said Dolby said that there are radio telescopes.
So, like,
yeah.
Maybe the
occupied.
I'm gonna say one.
I think
I still think that's optimistic, but we're going on.
So,
how
much
to write these? It's like an actual number.
That took a long
time. Keep going back and forth.
The first one is a number. The second one is between 0 and 1.
So,
for fractions, say between 0 and 1.
For fractions between 0 and 1.
4, 5, 6,
okay.
7.
Like a percent.
Okay.
Right.
Cycles to down.
And then the only two that are numbered, the only three that are numbered
yeah,
are the first one, true. The number of
so
yeah,
say
okay. Planets, and then
less than
1%.
More so
how would you some research?
Wait, are we doing the intelligence?
Yeah, so the fraction of life that actually evolves.
I think that's going to be the low.
Yeah,
okay, what is intelligence? Is intelligence even enough to
well, so afterwards, like, communicate.
Oh,
that means, like, it's going to be enough. Like, not even that. It's, like, being able to develop, like, language and actually, like, have it.
Yeah, my interpretation is FI is pretty low, but FC is more than
yeah, so if you can tell, like, intelligence is going to be
oh, yeah, how about intelligence is like multicellular?
But we also have to combine, like, you have to think about
FI and
FC. I think one of the things is like, together, that makes, like, out of any life, like, this is true. So, like, how much.
The prompt of FI and FC has to be the
how do you define intelligence? Because if it's communication, then it's as it is.
Yeah.
If it's tools, maybe a few monkeys. But if it's just general, like, do I know when to do things, then we're like snakes. I mean, then it's a lot.
It's hard to say that.
Because, like, communicative technology. So if you said that, like,
communicative technology that would be detectable from like years away.
Yeah.
So that's like.
You also have to think about Sophia whether they're willing to do it.
That's not an
alternative. Oh no, that's true because if you can see it, even like, I don't know, if there's a big like.
Yeah, I think that's probably.
Are you willing to broadcast it or not?
But it just says develops the technology.
So like, if you just have the radio with it, then it'd just be like. like 1945.
Yeah, so just like
the effects of the last
maybe they
how long are you willing to do it?
I mean just like you have to decide what intelligence means. You have to decide is that intelligence necessarily going to want to.
It's going to be
that we can check in as a race.
So let's say for FI, like that life from college tells us, I don't know, like 1%. And then for
and then for that one, like,
yeah, it's going to be very small.
Let's go with 9.
But it's also like
I would feel like 1 is something like that, or something
I think it's more important. What percent is that is actually what, because like humans have Earth, so like we
humans have like
we develop the communication technology, and so it's like that's like and that's it for 1 hour. So I think it's like I don't really know what percent.
When I look at my numbers, I'm very confused about how
much more per pen.
So much more estimated millions.
Well, like here it's only
very confused.
Because
how does that mean you're a pessimist or an optimist? There you go.
I guess the thing is, like, let's say there's a planet that.
You think if Neanderthals were still there, they'd be making technology.
You also have to think about, right? It's eventually.
Yeah.
Right? Could dolphins eventually build radio telescopes?
I don't know.
That's part of it, too. I think there's danger here in just using power.
So fractional
that's the pessimism versus
how many of those get communication
I think it's gonna be
life late communication is gonna be like
I think that's gonna be
it's gonna be optimistic. I would say like one in 20 million, one in 10 million. I think it's pretty
Okay, but are you guys saying FC as in like per species? Because it's really per planet.
Well, yeah, we're doing per planet. Like I don't know, how many species are here?
Well, yeah, so how many, like, because like, on this planet, like, the only one that's, like, actually, like, you can tell the place to be but it's only one per action.
I would argue that an increased number of species also promotes more evolutionary competition.
Yeah.
It increases the odds of that ability. So it's kind of like exponential for God.
Yeah.
This is a fun activity.
And now,
when average length of
time.
Well, yeah. So, like, that's weird because, like, do you say it's just like, because what was it? I think it was like Hitler's first, radio waves were the first to get past the ionosphere. So, like, so theoretically,
right,
like,
shut
the
this down.
What did you say?
No, it's true.
He's just saying a fact.
Those were the first that were strong enough to actually pierce the I think ionosphere.
That bodes well for our future.
Which is kind of funny, but also terrible. But like, I mean, it also got distorted. So like,
what is the ionosphere?
It's the part that like reflects radio waves like throughout the.
But on the Earth.
On the Earth, yes, yeah. It's like one of the parts of the ionosphere. But like, it bounces like it reflects lots of signals and stuff. But like it was finally strong enough to get past that in 1945, and so now it's like 2021. So that's like what 100 years? Like it's definitely gonna be longer than that. But like we only have that much time to place our body. So like how long do we think is that until we're done?
But maybe the other civilizations are smarter.
Yeah, I think that's also good. Because we just started, and so this could be like 1% of how long we're communicating, or it could be 20%.
So it could be most of the way through. Yeah. So do we want to assume that the average is going to be like existence? like much better than like what our projected one is, or
how many of you will die in the cloud?
I don't know. Like, it's so arbitrary.
Also, like,
it's
a good, like,
like,
for us to
like,
civilization.
How long do we think it's a civilization?
Yeah,
but it's only still only a sample size of one.
I know, but that's the only basis.
No, but I'm just saying you need to think about how long we'll be here, and then try and think about how close that is to the average of how long.
But, yeah, I know. But I'm trying to get a basis of how long we're here, and then just that proof also that they're smarter than us, like last one. Or
my opinion is between 10 and 100.
Okay.
I said some.
Yes, for like a base.
Between 10 and 1,000.
10 and 100,000. So like
10,000.
Oh, between 10,000 and
19,000.
I like 50,000. That's
a it's like optimistic.
Yeah. No, it's definitely optimistic, but we're going
it's
to have to figure out.
It's optimistic for the sake of being effective. Avoiding being festive.
All right, we have our numbers.
We're so smart.
Yeah, what do we multiply this by to get the, like, how many?
Oh, yeah, there you go.
Just multiply all the numbers together.
Yeah, and it's going to give us a fraction.
Yeah. Number of detectable
situations.
Yeah,
oh, yeah,
we
can pass
the
if your number is less than 1, it's 0.
Okay,
right?
Then that means not even us, right?
Yeah, I guess that means we
are. So if it's less than 0, I'm
going to there is a lower bound of this number.
If it's less than 0, you did math.
Oh, my God.
If it's less than
1, then we did it wrong.
It's more
less than
0.
Negative
fraction. It still could be.
Yeah. We are good.
I think that's definitely what it means.
We know about 1.
Think about
it.
All NASA
says
there's like 2 trillion galaxies in the
universe.
Sorry.
Are they
just
really
waiting for the results over there?
No.
I
want to
read
that.
No, it's
no.
Just
if I got an N
no.
Or less than 1,
no.
I would
like
interpret that as
number
2.
I have a number.
We don't
less
have
than
you should
have.
What if it's less than 1?
That just
so
means
there's a lot of talk
here at all. Because then there shouldn't be.
If I got a number less than 1, I wouldn't assume that means we're the only.
Like I said, you can get, you know, really big.
It's not a question
someone
of
next
sure.
Door.
That's
or
not
really right. Small. More
but is that but, right? Isn't that how you interpret it?
Well, this is also just ones that we can actually communicate.
Yeah.
They, like, realize they're there.
Yes.
I guess that might
be. So if you want to do, if you figure out the number of stars on the Milky Way and take away the time dependency, then that could be an interesting number.
How many stars are there in the Milky Way?
I'm thinking about the total for the total life of the Milky Way because we're thinking about things that are literally like hundreds of thousands of light years
away. So if they existed 100,000 years ago,
what? Is it a different calculation?
Yeah. So that's what I want.
I just
use
like having a green as counting for intelligence,
and most animals have a green.
It's about 100 billion stars.
Yeah, the intelligence is actually pretty high.
I figure like 80% of them could actually have
the number
that we generally consider the brightest stars.
There's
too much in this way, and then you can't hang on to the atmosphere and stuff.
And until they take in the star.
So there's some adjustment there.
It's like 10 to the 6 because they're
going to be a
single
digit. I guess by that,
it kind of makes sense.
Like the number of Milky Way galaxies is less than 1.
I think that
plus it should be much higher. There's so many more stars.
It's less utilitarian results, I guess. Insightful.
So it's 10 to the 9.
What was like the point of your paper?
Yeah, no, you're right. Much.
So we just take, we're talking about
12, 30,
17, all the fractions.